Ovadia, and this is Career Chat, brought to you by Miami University's Office of Career Services. Today we're speaking with Professor Lisa Marie Lucioni on the topic of business etiquette. Professor Lucioni is a communication professor at the University of Cincinnati and a recognized expert in the fields of business etiquette and professional image. As the only certified image professional in the state of Ohio, Professor Lucioni has been featured on radio, in newspapers, and in magazines regarding issues related to etiquette and professionalism. Most recently, Professor Lucioni appeared as a live guest on CNN's Anderson Cooper 360 show to discuss the topic of increased rudeness in America. Professor Lucioni starts this episode of Career Chat with a few helpful tips for students facing a phone interview.
When you have an in-person interview, you have access to a whole collection of nonverbal cues. For example, we look at somebody's facial expressions. We look at their clothing. We look at their grooming. We feel the firmness of their handshake. We notice that they're nodding their head as we speak or their eye contact. When you are being interviewed over the phone, all of those nonverbal cues are now deleted. So the person who is interviewing us can only really form perceptions about us based on two key factors. They form perceptions about us based on the words that we use and also the voice that we use to issue those words. And in terms of statistics, the research shows that 30% of a person's perception of us is based on the words that we use over the phone, which leaves a whopping 70% for the actual voice. So when we're being interviewed, keep in mind that an enthusiastic voice is very important, which kind of leans into the importance of articulation. Oftentimes, and I find myself doing this as well, we go into more informal speech, gonna, woulda, shoulda. And while fine in everyday conversation in a professional interview, which this certainly still is, although the medium is very much different, we want to ensure that we articulate, want to, going to, and so on.
Voicemail messages present yet another interview component to which students should pay attention.
In terms of the phone interviews, they're probably going to be calling you perhaps to even set up an interview. Make sure that your voicemail message sounds polished and professional. I'm often surprised by students and indeed even my own friends who will have like music playing on their voicemail messages. Mm-hmm. Or very inappropriate sort of message, overly casual, for example, and it doesn't necessarily send the best message. If any of your students were interviewing me and they were calling my home to set up an interview, please rest assured that they would have, I like to think, a very polished and professional message that would communicate a very polished communicator.
While it may not matter what you wear during a phone interview, in-person interviews are another matter. Professor Lucioni advises students to choose their dress wisely.
Here's my advice. I've studied image a long time, and I know that students in college don't have a lot of money. I empathize. I understand. I've been there. My main recommendation is to buy fewer pieces, but buy better pieces. I really don't think that any student, I don't care what field they're in, could go wrong with a navy suit. Navy takes you anywhere. For example, if you are a gentleman, it takes you to a job interview, it takes you to a wedding, it takes you to a funeral, it takes you to an evening event. It's a put on and go kind of suit. Gray, I think, also works as well. Keep in mind that the darker the color, the more powerful you appear. So say, for example, somebody were to go into their closet and have a light gray suit, a medium gray suit, and a charcoal dark gray suit. Gray is going to be a powerful color anyway because socially we are conditioned to view people wearing gray as powerful, credible, authoritative. But the darker that gray is going to be, the more powerful they're going to appear.
How do I look?
From pinstripes to plaid, Professor Lucioni lists the most and least authoritative fabrics.
Pinstripes, by far, the most powerful pattern. And in terms of most authoritative to least authoritative, the ranking would be pinstripe, solid, chalk stripe, and I'll define. Chalk stripe is kind of like an exaggerated pinstripe. Mm-hmm. And then you have plaid, which we are not going to wear, I would suspect, for a job interview, unless, of course, it is perhaps a gentleman or a woman, maybe in a creative field where they're expected to maybe be a little bit more creative in their clothing choices.
Dude, I'm telling you, it's jobs. We gotta get jobs. Then we get the khakis.
Professor Lucioni says body build should be considered when deciding between single and double-breasted suits.
Students will ask about single-breasted and double-breasted suits. That's a question that I will often get. I would advise all students, before they get their wardrobe, to take a look at their body build, for example. I've had clients who are 6'4" tall. They have very massive shoulders, very long legs, and they overpower when they walk into a room. They certainly have presence. People know that they're there, and that can be really great. But if we were to put them, Micah, in a navy double-breasted suit, that might come across as very strong, and it might put some people off. It might make them apprehensive. So what that person might do is wear a softer color, like a lighter gray, in a solid sort of this, so then he becomes more approachable, more friendly. What is his specific goal? Does he wish to empower himself and be viewed as authoritative? Then he can power up. But if he wants to be seen as softer and approachable, he might wear the lighter colors.
How do I look?
According to Professor Lucioni, women need to be particularly mindful of how their choice of dress affects their credibility.
Women need to be aware, and I practice this myself, that the more skin that we show, the more credibility we lose. A good piece of advice for women in working America to remember is to raise the necklines and to lower the hemlines. A lot of women might have beautiful legs and more power to them, but sometimes the skirts are cut so short, especially when they're seated, that that can be a distraction. And it can be something that you're competing against. And male students and male corporate audiences will agree with this. They just hesitate to say anything in person because they fear maybe possibly sexual harassment, or they don't want to voice an a sentiment that might be construed in a certain way. But it's when I'm watching the televisions, I just had a colleague and I, a fellow image consultant, and I were talking about this. I'm looking at the newscasters, and you'll by and large see men wearing their suit, you know, the three-piece jacket, the jacket, and they'll have the tie. But then you'll see the women wearing sleeveless tops, and you're seeing a lot of the skin. And if you look at them side by side, the woman, I think, really loses a lot of credibility by showing as much skin. And I'm not saying that it's always inappropriate. That's not my message. But my message is that when we show a lot of cleavage, or we show a lot of arm, or we show a lot of leg, that is decreasing our power in terms of perception. Keep in mind, most importantly, that just because something is in fashion and people say that, oh, it's in the magazine, it's okay to wear this, it's not necessarily. I'll get directors of HR who will hire me to go into their company, and they'll say, Lisa Marie, kind of make this point. They'll have women who are wearing their suits, and they look very nice. Maybe they're woven. They have the straight lines, the angular shapes, but they're wearing a very lacy camisole underneath. And to a lot of people, those are read as evening attire, not necessarily work appropriate. Now, I'm certain there are some fields where that lacy camisole might be more appropriate, but in the more conservative fields especially, it doesn't matter that you're wearing it underneath a woven navy or gray suit. It's maybe too much, a little too sexy. Everything communicates. The way that we look, the way that we talk, the way that we email, the way that we answer the phone, the way that we answer questions when we're being interviewed on the phone, everything communicates. And it's important to use that information wisely, strategically, so that you and I and the listeners can emphasize ourselves in the best possible way.
Accessories also play an important role in a student's appearance. As with clothing, Professor Lucioni advises against purchasing low-quality goods.
In terms of accessories, when we're buying briefcases or portfolios or purses, invest in quality pieces. You don't want anything that's going to look cheap or tacky. And again, I know that college students are on a limited budget, but it's something that they can either save up for, or they can get it for the holidays or as graduation gifts, because those are very much noticed.
When it comes to jewelry, Professor Lucioni recommends taking a less is more approach.
Keep in mind that jewelry is meant to enhance. In terms of, you can't go wrong with tasteful and elegant. It is an accessory. It's not to take the place of who you are. I know, for example, in fashion today that a lot of the women are wearing those dangling chandelier earrings. They're very much trendy. They're very much in vogue. And I notice that a lot of women are wearing them. This is fine in a social environment, but keep in mind that in a business environment, I'm not so certain you want everyone's attention to go toward your ears, because you're competing. Mm-hmm. They're mm-hmm. twirling around and you're competing against that. Oftentimes, in terms of wearing jewelry on the right hand, I have, when you shake somebody's hand, if they have a ring that is especially oversized, it can be very painful. So keep that in mind. I think minimal is probably the best.
Everybody be cool. You be cool.
As for tattoos, Professor Lucioni notes that employers may react negatively toward a candidate who displays them.
You are more than entitled and allowed to wear your tattoo, but the interviewer is more than allowed and entitled to not hire you because of that. You know, mm-hmm. they might not comment on the fact that you have this big tattoo, but they're probably noticing it. Most people form negative perceptions because they'll think not as necessarily professional, when in fact that person sporting the tattoo might be the most professional, polished candidate under consideration. But I think that, again, you can't go wrong being conservative.
Interviews conducted over a meal can present a special set of challenges to students. Professor Lucioni offers advice for the dining interview.
Read between the lines, Theo. Read between the lines!
If you are being interviewed, they're assessing not only your technical ability, but they're thinking, can I send you, the person being interviewed, out to represent not only yourself, but by extension, my company? Do you have good manners? Do you know how to be a host yourself when you are trying to wine and dine potential clients? You know, there's a skill to that. There's value in that. When you're being interviewed, keep in mind that the person interviewing you is technically the host. You are the guest. And if you have a good host or a good interviewer, they will give you cues that you can follow. For example, when you sit down, usually we would place the napkin in our laps as soon as we sit down. But if we have a host, in which the interviewer is, you follow his or her cue. The host should then say to us, they'll make recommendations. The fill in the blank and fill in the blank are very good here. What they're doing is they are, number one, letting you know the specials, which is very much appreciated, but they're letting you know the price range. So be aware of that cue. But let's say, for example, that we're being interviewed by somebody who is very charming. However, they're not necessarily cued in as to how to be a good host. So what do we do as students being interviewed? Well, we can ask this question, Mr. Ovadia, is there anything that you would recommend? And then that would open the floor to you to, you know, make some suggestions. In any event, I now better know. Keep in mind that everything does communicate. For example, I reveal personal information. I love coffee and I love NutraSweet or Splenda. I will put my cream in my coffee, and I love, for example, 4 NutraSweets or Splendas, and that's because I like it very sweet. Mm-hmm. Well, if I were at home in the privacy of my home or with family and friends who know me, I would rip away at the 4 or 5 Splendas and stir them in my coffee. But during an interview, I'm not so certain that's something that I want to do. It might be read as excess. Mm-hmm. It might be read as, you know, addictive. You know, it might be decoded in a variety of ways. You know, and some people think, oh, Lisa Marie, come on, that's reading too much into it. Respectfully, I would point out, ladies and gentlemen, no, everything does communicate. I'm not saying it's fair. I'm just saying that these cues are read and decoded in a certain way. I would avoid alcohol. That seems to be a given, and yet that's a common question that I'll get from students. What if I'm offered a beverage, even if I am of the age to drink? This is a job interview. I would respectfully decline. You know, that's not something that I would probably do. I think that the potential to be read negatively is too high for that. In terms of getting that etiquette book, this is why there is a proper way to hold a fork and a proper way to hold a knife when we're cutting, for example, our chicken breast. And I've taught enough dining tutorials to know that students much smarter than me, and I admit it, are holding their silverware incorrectly. And that can be a big turnoff to a lot of people doing the interviewing. I speak with a lot of director of human resources, and they'll reveal that they're looking for those sort of cues. Do you know what is your bread plate? Do you know which one is your drink? Bread is to the left, drinks are to the right. But this is what an etiquette book will teach. You know, what are the proper resting positions, for example?
So what should a student do following an interview? According to Professor Lucioni, sending a thank you note is a must.
Every time we are interviewed in person, over the phone, a thank you note of some sort should be sent. I'll have students in the classroom who will walk in and tell me, Lisa Marie, I just interviewed with, and they'll name the company, and immediately I'll come back with, did you send a thank you note? And oftentimes there's a blank look on their face. Well, no, I haven't. Mr. or Ms. such and such, please write that thank you note and get it out within 24 hours. I would use this as a general guideline. However your form of communication has been thus far, that's probably a safe way in which to thank the person. If you, for example, are conducting an interview, and most of your pre-interview communication has occurred online through email, then by all means, I don't think there's anything wrong with typing out an email thank you, sending it to the person. But I think, in my professional opinion, it's a really great idea to send a follow-up email afterwards. For example, it could be handwritten or it could be something typed. I think it depends on the person receiving the thank you. I, because I am a communication professor, am a stickler for proper business correspondence. So I would be very impressed by somebody who would, yes, send me the email nicely drafted with my name spelled correctly. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. And thanking me for the interview. But then I would also like for somebody to type me a letter using professional business correspondence format, which a lot of people are unfamiliar with, but then send it to me. If writing is a part of their job, if they are going to be writing letters as part of their job requirement, then I want to see that they know how to create and draft a professional letter. Some director of human resources prefer handwritten notes, you know? So I think it's just a matter of sending something.
In corresponding via email, Professor Lucioni stresses the importance of polished and professional communication.
Email doesn't have, again, access to the nonverbal cues. I can't see your face. I can't see the eye contact. I can't see the head nods. The only way that I can form a perception about you and you about me is the writing that appears on the screen. So make sure that whatever we write on the email is going to be polished and crisp and clear and spelled correctly with proper grammar. That's invaluable. My last name is Lucioni, and I'm often surprised by how many people can't even take the time to spell my name correctly. That is a big turnoff to a lot of people. You might otherwise be a very strong candidate, but if you totally misspell somebody's name or even have one letter off, some people view that as an attention to detail issue. And that might be a red mark, so to speak, against us, which is unfortunate. And again, it might not seem fair, but in today's increasingly competitive society, something as simple as that might hurt our chances of getting the job. In terms of email subject lines rule, I always encourage students, and I myself am an advocate of this, to put subject lines within every email that I write and get as specific as possible. If I see a blank email, and especially if I don't recognize where it's coming from, unfortunately, I'll delete it because I don't want to take the chance of opening it up and have some sort of virus spread to my computer. So I'll delete it. And I know oftentimes people will do that as well. I don't want my emails deleted. I doubt you want your emails deleted. I don't think the students want their emails deleted. So put the subject line in, not "Hey, you," or "meeting," but 4 o'clock accounting meeting changes. That's something that's a little bit more specific. I would say this to students, and again, I know that you've spent so many years in getting your education, thousands of dollars in financing it, but these little small points can hurt us. I'll check students' emails and it will have hotgirl8 at, you know, hotmail.com, you know? And it's something to keep in mind, or "I'm a jock," you know, at AOL.com. And they're overly informal. They don't convey necessarily the professional image that in the corporate world you wish to convey.
I guess we're playing for keeps now. I guess the kidding around is pretty much over, huh?
In conclusion, Professor Lucioni addresses sweat, a problem many students face during the stress of an interview.
One of the questions that I will get the most, and they'll usually send it email because I think they feel uncomfortable asking it in a public forum, and I understand why. They want to talk about sweat, excessive sweat, and how do they handle that? You know, and I've got some good advice, I think, in terms of underarm sweat, which again, this is a problem that a lot of students are that they face and they struggle with. There are some products that I would advise. The first requires a prescription, and it's called Drysol, DrySol. A lot of my athlete students use it, and they tell me that it stops sweat. But a product that I can personally vouch for is called Certain Dry, and it's CERTAIN-DRY, DRI. You can find that in a variety of stores. I've always purchased it at Walgreens, but that's a very powerful product, you know. And I remember reading not that long ago where they interviewed a group of Fortune 500 executives, and they asked these executives what creates a negative perception. And the number one answer was arrogance, which I understand. Mm-hmm. There's a difference between confidence and cockiness, yes. But the second common answer was sweaty handshakes, you know, sweaty
really?
Hands, yes. Mm-hmm. And my heart dropped when I read that because I thought, oh, I bet the reason people have sweaty hands is because they're so nervous and they wish to create a favorable impression.
Sure.
But it's, you know, to a lot of people, it's a turnoff. So those are something they might want to consider for underarm sweat, something that some of your listeners might view as radical, but I've had clients who have done this. There's Botox, B-O-T-O-X. It's not covered by insurance, but basically it has been approved, as I understand, by the FDA, Food and Drug Administration, and it does need to be repeated, I believe, every 3 months. It can cost around $500, more or less, but they can inject it, for example, under your arms, and basically what it will do is to paralyze the sweat muscle.
Career Chat is available on iTunes. To find more episodes of Career Chat, simply visit the iTunes store and do a keyword search for Career Chat. That's Career Chat, all one word.